Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The other piece of information we do get from this report is the number of egg type hatching layers, you know, which tells us what is the industry doing to try and build the table laying flock going forward. And on January 1st, we were looking at about 3.8 million egg type hatching layers, which was about 11% above a year ago.
Shel Shagham is a USDA livestock analyst. He says USDA's latest chicken and egg report shows that egg producers are working to rebuild laying flocks.
So again, their industry is working very hard to try and rebuild their flocks. But as it stands now, we are still have a flock that is on January 1st that was about 6% below a year ago.
This is Agriculture Today.
In addition to that, I'm excited to share three more place-based opportunities from DOE.
Jennifer Granholm is Secretary of Energy with the Department of Energy at the U.S. Conference of Mayors.
The first one is the up to $50 million Buildings Upgrade Prize, or Buildings Up. And that is for energy efficient and electrification, energy efficiency and electrification upgrades in existing buildings. If you're interested, it is a multi-phase competition. We're asking teams of state and local governments and community organizations and tribes and utilities, building owners. We want them to start developing concept plans to decarbonize existing buildings. We're especially encouraging under-resourced teams and first-time applicants for DOE funding to apply. We've got an application support prize for help if you need it. And this is the competition's first phase. And in this first phase, teams are going to receive expert technical assistance from DOE to bring their ideas to life. And up to 60 teams in the first phase will receive up to $400,000 in cash. That's phase one. If you're interested, you can get in touch with Holly Carr, C-A-R-R, at our Building Technologies office in the Department of Energy.
Many times, Granholm explains things are good for cities, but what about rural communities?
So the third new opportunity comes through our Office of Clean Energy Demonstrations. And they have launched the Energizing Rural Communities Prize. And that's to bring energy to rural and remote communities across the nation. It's made possible, again, by the bipartisan infrastructure law. It recognizes that nearly 50 million Americans live in places where energy costs are way too high and where service is often unreliable. So teams in that prize will focus either on connecting those communities to government opportunities and a network of partners across to access funding for clean energy projects. That's got a $10 million cash prize pool, or innovative financing models to access new capital, and that's got a $5 million pool.
But she also admits that if one city wants more.
The fourth new opportunity from DOE focuses on, this is super important, creating a technical roadmap for your city if you want it. If you want to achieve 100% clean energy, we did this with LA 100. We're launching today the Clean Energy to Communities Program, or C2C. It builds off the success of this LA 100 study, which used the National Renewable Energy Lab. Of course, DOE's got 17 national labs. NREL is one of them. They worked with LA to map out the technical strategy for LA to reach 100% clean electricity by 2045. And they're ready to do that now. They've created the tool to be able to do it. Every city is different, right? So we want to be able to do the same for your city if you're interested in that. C2C, that's going to connect hundreds of communities with all types of technical experts from our national labs and our advanced modeling capacities to chart, to test different pathways to go clean. And for that, you can learn more at NREL.gov/C2C, NREL.gov/C2C.
Speaking at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, Department of Energy's Jennifer Granholm. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
There are a lot of variables in farming, right? Soil types, climate, moisture. But the bottom line is that agriculture is a business.
At a hearing last year in front of the House Ag Committee, G.T. Thompson was the ranking member, now the chairman of that committee from Pennsylvania.
And at the end of the day, it's not what you bring in, it's the margin you're left with. And I have tremendous concerns with where we're heading right now. On that note, while prices for most commodities are at high levels and some paint a rosy picture for agriculture, I think it's mostly by folks who really don't understand it, that farming is a business, and at the end of the day, it's the margin you're left with, if any. I'm not optimistic about this. Net farm income projections are based on an expectation of average yields, which is not a given. Additionally, it will only take some softening of prices before producers may be underwater. As you've well stated, commodity prices can drop overnight, but input costs, once they're up there, it's difficult to see them lower.
During the hearing, Joe Outlaw with the Agriculture Food Policy Center at Texas A&M on whether a permanent disaster program needs to exist.
In general, the crop insurance industry and the products that are available are sufficient. What we have found over time is that natural disasters don't worry about what policy you bought. And so it has been a case where there has been added help provided to cover portion of the deductible area. It is certainly within logical thinking to think that if we've done this 5 years in a row, likely we're going to continue to do this. There's going to be natural disasters, and it would be helpful if there was a plan in place or a set of rules in place of exactly how it was going to work so that producers would understand what kind of help they might get if this happened, and not leave it to chance or whether you get something passed.
University of Illinois ag economist Joe Jansen on a standing disaster program.
The issue in developing a standing disaster assistance program is always how to define what constitutes a disaster and when will the government step in and when will they not. And that's why these programs have been ad hoc. And the crop insurance program does a good job of defining the types of losses that will be covered. And so a standing disaster assistance program looks a lot like insurance, but covering the things that we didn't know about the future.
Also looking into the future, Outlaw talked about ARC and PLC.
In the 2014 Farm Bill, that decision was a one-time for the life of the Farm Bill decision, and it really stressed producers out trying to make that decision for the next 5 years, much less what's going to happen this year. The 2018 Farm Bill changed that and made it an annual decision after the first 2 years, and producers would have to decide on an annual basis which of those two products they wanted to go to. All I'm saying is take the decision away from them and allow them, if there was a benefit to be had, allow them to have the higher of the two. A lot of times they're both going to be negative, or I mean not negative, but zero. And so, but they're good at farming and they don't want to make this decision, and they're really, it puts a lot of undue stress on them. Just give them whichever would be higher, and it can be scored that way.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Over the last 30 years, and indeed over the past half century, China's leaders have been remarkably constant in their objectives, but highly flexible in the means with which they've pursued them.
How could it be that the U.S. got China wrong? Aaron Friedberg is professor of politics at Princeton.
And this, I think, is in marked contrast to the United States and the West more generally, which have been rigid with respect to both, so clinging until very recently to forlorn hopes and failed policies. The troubling trends in Beijing's behavior that have become unmistakable in the past decade under Xi Jinping actually have their origins a good bit earlier, in the first decade of the 21st century. In other words, these developments are not the handiwork of one man, but instead appear to reflect a broad consensus among the CCP's top leaders about what's necessary to meet changing conditions. And she is a convenient villain for many people, and in some respects, a hopeful interpretation, because if you believe it's all him, once he goes away, maybe things will get better. But in fact, it's the system of which he's a part, rather than the man himself, that's the root cause of our problems with the PRC. And finally, in each domain, political, economic, and strategic, recognition of what was actually happening has been delayed by prevailing misconceptions and stubborn expectations in the liberal democratic West. The belief that a determined Leninist regime would somehow permit multi-party democracy to take root and a true market-driven economy, which would by its nature undermine the power of the state, to emerge. And the belief also, and this one is particularly odd, I think, in retrospect, although many intelligent people, I think, held this view, that the People's Republic would somehow be content to become little more than a member in good standing of a U.S.-led and organized international system, one which, if you step back and look at it, is built on principles which are inimical to the legitimacy and potentially, therefore, to the survival of the CCP. The concluding chapter of the book digs more deeply into the question of why it's taken so long for the United States and other Western countries to acknowledge the failure of the policies that they've been pursuing for the past 30 years, and why things started to change when and how they did. And that's an interesting story in and of itself, and it's not one that's complete, because I don't think we've fully made this transformation. And in the concluding chapter, I also offer some prescriptions for the future. Again, I'd be happy to discuss those in more detail, but let me just close with my overarching conclusion, and I would frame it in this way. We, that is the United States and our democratic allies, have to begin by acknowledging that as happened after the First and Second World Wars, so also in the wake of the Cold War, our efforts to create an integrated and truly global liberal international order have failed. But, and this is the crucial caveat in my mind, instead of abandoning that project altogether, we need to fall back to a more defensible position, redrawing the perimeters and strengthening the boundaries of a geographically limited liberal international subsystem encompassing democracies in Europe, Asia, and North America, among other places, from which we can better promote our interests and protect our common values, much as we did at the start of the Cold War. In short, we need to avoid the lessons, or rather the mistakes, of the 20s and 30s when we lapsed back into isolation and relearn the constructive lessons of the 1940s and 1950s.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We know that history doesn't sort of repeat itself directly.
Joe Jansen is a University of Illinois ag economist.
But there are probably some of the factors, that some of the things that were major forces in the grain markets in 2022 that might also be significant factors in 2023. So we can take a little bit of a reminiscence here. What happened in 2022? You know, we started the year with corn and soybean prices that we thought were pretty good. Corn prices in the fives, soybean prices around, say, $13-$14 a bushel. Those were, pretty good price levels. There were a bunch of things that happened that really no one saw coming. The first one really hit the soybean market in early, mid-January, continued through that month when we got sort of some news about South America's corn and soybean crop, particularly that soybean crop out of Brazil and Argentina coming in much smaller than would be initially expected. That lit a fire under the soybean market. Also some strength in corn, but the real big rally in corn happened in late February. We have sort of probably the biggest news, the biggest sort of unexpected thing in 2022 was obviously the Russian invasion of Ukraine. That really kind of moved us into a bit of a new paradigm where we thought there was, significant supplies of grain, particularly wheat and corn, in a part of the world where that grain couldn't get to, the final end user. Russia and Ukraine, both massive grain exporters. And the thought was that, a significant amount of their, production would be curtailed and then existing, inventories would be tied up in that part of the world. That got us to, $7.50-ish, old crop corn prices. Obviously the prospects for new crop were sort of diminished. We know that, when the market has some time to build some supply response, We think that the market, you know, that suppliers will respond in other parts of the world. So that new crop prices, the lower lines in both of these graphs, maintain, were at lower levels than old crop prices. So that new crop, old crop inverse, has been kind of with us this whole time. It continues to this day. Coming out of that period where we had the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we see prices really fall back going into the summer months. In part, I mean, the biggest sort of news story there was the Russia-Ukraine grain deal that would allow for maritime exports from Ukraine. So we had all that grain tied up in Ukraine. Some of it was trying to move by other means, by rail and truck outside of the country. But really, they can't move that crop without the ability to export through the Black Sea. That happened. And, you know, just generally speaking, the sense was that, you know, the supply and demand situation, the ability of grain to flow around the world, that some of that supply chain tightness was being relaxed. We saw prices move lower. And then kind of coming into the harvest period, especially for corn, we saw that U.S. yield prospects were, you know, significantly lower than what was initially what our initial expectations were. And that kind of brought us to corn prices, you know, in and around that $7 range. And we've kind of been somewhere in that $6.50 to $7 range ever since. The last sort of piece of news here was really at the end of the year, we've seen some news about South America and about the South American crop prospects, really kind of lending support to old crop soybean prices. So you can see on the far right of the slide, just this divergence between old crop and new crop soybean prices. Lots of strength in the old crop, less so in the new crop. And that's really about sort of like, can we, you know, maintain product flow through the remainder of this crop year till we get a crop from South America?
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The most recent trustees report tells us that Social Security is headed towards insolvency.
Maya McGinnis is president for Responsible Federal Budget on how to address the issue.
Of course, that is not news. We have known this for more than 30 years. And yet in that time, we have basically done nothing to make the program shore it up so that it's financially solvent. We now have a situation where the combined trust funds will be insolvent by around 2035 when today's 54-year-olds reach full retirement age. So the one thing we know that increases anxiety is uncertainty, and that is what people have today about the future of Social Security. Upon insolvency, all beneficiaries, everyone, millionaires, and people who depend on Social Security for their entire livelihood will receive benefit cuts across the board to 20%, and that will grow over time. So I can point to a lot of good proposals over the years. This is clearly not one of them. Every year we wait, and that we have waited, has made the changes more difficult and more painful. In 2010, you could have achieved 75-year solvency by eliminating the taxable maximum or price indexing benefits. Today, neither of those will be sufficient. In 2010, the Simpson-Bowles plan was going to phase in all of its policies over 40 years. Today, the same type of plan would have to be phased in 5 to 10 years. So continued delay will make the needed changes even larger, while giving participants even less time to prepare. So what should the goals of the reforming the system be? And there are plenty of different objectives, and that's part of the reason we should have compromise. What I believe needs to happen is that we need to make the program solvent before we expand benefits. I think we need to protect those who depend on the program. I think we should make changes that encourage economic growth wherever possible. And finally and importantly, I think we have to think about this comprehensively. So recognizing that Social Security is one of many national priorities and that acknowledging that there are trade-offs between funding for Social Security versus other priorities such as investment in children, climate, national security, and many other priorities. As to the first objective, there are plans out there that would expand benefits and fail to make Social Security solvent. This is akin to saying to seniors, we will promise you even more while we know that we cannot even pay you what we have already promised. This is dangerous and it's disingenuous. Second, I think it makes sense to make these changes progressively, and the options to do this include things like lifting the tax cap, means testing, progressive price indexing, and or adding minimum benefits along with other changes to enhance solvency. On this objective, I find it really hard to understand those who advocate more in taxes on the rich while ruling out slowing the growth of benefits for the same people. Changes will have to be made. If wealthy beneficiaries are held harmless, others will have to face more in benefit reductions or pay more in taxes. And the more we do this by raising their taxes rather than reducing benefits, the less revenue from that group will be available for other priorities. You can only tax millionaires and billionaires so many times. Another useful objective is to include changes that create incentives for work, savings, and growth. This is particularly important because of the economic challenges we face because of the aging of the population. Finally, it's very important to look and think about Social Security in the context of the full budget as well as an independent program. Already, the federal government spends roughly $6 per senior on every one it spends for children. So we need to think holistically about whether we want to widen that gap or we want to narrow that gap. There's both a financial and a political budget constraint in overall spending, and by contemplating programs in isolation, you bypass the consideration of those trade-offs. The right and the best way to start this discussion is to pass a budget.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
A USDA beef quality grade gets assigned to a beef carcass to indicate the tenderness, juiciness, and flavor of cooked beef.
Dr. Mark Johnson is Oklahoma State Beef Cattle Breeding Specialist.
Specifically, if we think about what a USDA grader is looking at whenever they assign those quality grades to beef carcasses, two primary things. The degree of marbling in the ribeye at the interface between the 12th and 13th rib of a hanging beef carcass, where that carcass is actually going to be ribbed open, and the maturity that they would put that beef carcass in. We want to address the maturity concept first because the A maturity group that most calf-fed and yearlings that go through finishing are going to fall into basically is designed to catch cattle that are from about 9 months of age to 30 months of age. So I always say, regardless in conventional beef production, regardless of when we send those calves to the finishing yard, if we're starting off with lighter weight calves that maybe haven't been turned into yearlings or long yearlings in either case, conventional beef production, we tend to feed those cattle or finish them on a high energy corn-based diet for at least 150 days. The objective is to tap their genetic potential to marble. And so they're going to come out of finishing and reach their compositional endpoint within that A maturity group. So in that sense, the big thing that drives the quality grade of A maturity cattle is going to be their marbling score. Now, marbling scores are going to be assigned by a USDA grader and possibly with a little instrumental supplementation information going along with it. That marbling score is going to correspond to a specific yield grade. What are the best potential quality grades that we see assigned to A maturity cattle? Prime is our highest quality grade. The prime quality grade means we should have the most tenderness, juiciness, and flavor and eating satisfaction out of a cut of cooked beef. The quality grade of choice falls just below that. The quality grade of select falls just below that. And the standard quality grade would actually be our lowest quality grade for A maturity cattle. If we take a look at the accompanying chart, we see that prime can be split into thirds. The quality grade of choice can be split into thirds based on marbling score. That has significance because if we are selling fed cattle on a carcass value basis, there's a lot of the quality-based premium branded programs, think something like CAB or Certified Angus Beef, that one of the specs to certify there is being in the upper two-thirds of choice or actually prime. So as we look at grids, carcass value marketing, over time, historically, quality grade is the big driver of economic incentive that gives beef carcasses more value. So obviously the genetic potential of beef cattle to marble is going to be really important because we think about marbling as a fat deposit. It's one of the fat deposits we find in a beef carcass, but it's one we can't really see in the live animal itself. When we talk about finishing cattle to a compositional endpoint, that compositional endpoint is based more on external fat thickness that indicates to us that they should have that marbling inside that we hope is there. So the whole finishing process itself is to get a high energy diet in those cattle to tap that genetic potential to marble. So the amount of time spent on feed, as that increases, we're going to tend to drive up quality grades on beef carcasses, and just the genetic potential within breeds and between breeds is a big player in that variability and genetic potential to actually reach the higher quality grades.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Our nation's produce industry, fruits, vegetables, and other specialty crops, is highly labor-intensive on the farm level. Yet, as USDA economic researcher Skylar Simnett explains,
there's a general consensus in the U.S. right now that domestic farm workers are getting harder to find. As evidence of that, the farm wage rate is increasing faster than the non-farm wage rate for non-supervisory positions. When supply is not keeping up with demand, you end up with a higher equilibrium price, which in that case is the wage rate. So we find that growers, particularly in the produce industries, are affected by this, and that's because their products are labor-intensive. And also, a larger share of their total cost expenditures, as you'd think, would go to labor.
As a result, growers are looking into other production and management strategies to offset rising labor costs, some short-term, others at a longer range of time. Examples range from using existing mechanical aids to developing new and improving existing technologies. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.